I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. The Panama Papers is the largest whistleblower leak in history, involving more than 11 million confidential documents from the Panama law firm of Mossack Fonseca. The release last week shed light on the shadowy world of offshore banking, tax evasion, and money laundering involving powerful politicians, business leaders, celebrities, and wealthy and well-connected individuals from across the world. The information was given to a reporter at a German newspaper that shared the information with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that organized reporters to comb through the data. The ICIJ released the information, and it's damning and still reverberating, shedding light on global corruption and questions involving secret financial transactions. And while Panama has some explaining to do, they are not alone. In fact, some U.S. states are seen as an attractive and friendly tax haven. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. And joining us is Gerard Ryle. He is investigative journalist and director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and that's at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. He oversees more than 190 member journalists, I should say, in more than 65 countries. And Gerard Ryle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be back. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is James Henry. He's an investigative economist and lawyer, and he's working closely with filmmakers and journalists who are investigating the Panama Papers. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment and a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, the author of a number of books, including the forthcoming Pirate Bankers. And James Henry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
Gerard, let me begin with you and just a couple of questions about what has been released so far. Are there more documents that you will be releasing?
Yes, we hope to actually publish a redacted version of the documents early next month. And by that, I mean the very basic information on who is in there and what companies do they own in the offshore tax havens. It's something that we did before with a previous leak of information. And, of course, the journalists that we're working with, and we're talking about 370 of them working in more than 100 different media organizations, are still publishing and writing and reporting and digging away.
Are you going to release in the end all the information, or is there some information that you're going to hold back?
No, we don't believe that we should publish it all because there's a lot of very private information in there, including details on passports, actual passports, banking information, bank accounts, home addresses, things like that.
And what do we know, or should we know more about who this individual was who leaked it? I know when he leaked it, he described himself as John Doe. He said, "My life is in danger." Do you know anything more about this person?
I know that this person contacted a reporter in Germany we work with called Bastian Obermeier, and all of the communication has been very secure. I don't believe that Bastian knows who this person is. Of course, we had a heavy burden at the beginning of this project more than a year ago because we were dealing with an anonymous source. So we were very careful to go outside the documents to verify that they were real and to, I guess, establish public interest in these documents, which, to be frank, wasn't that hard. There were many, many public figures from around the world, including sort of 12 current and former world leaders.
I want to get to all of that. Let me get you, James Henry, in on the conversation. There's so much to talk about when it comes to the Panama Papers. What is your takeaway?
Well, one thing is that this is, first of all, foremost, a tribute to the power of whistleblowers and also investigative journalists. I mean, these revelations did not come out by way of law enforcement or the NSA or any government action. For better or worse, you know, that we might have liked to have more transparency. This came from the sort of hardworking, my hat's off to Gerald and his team. Journalists around the world who are basically doing this because they're trying to make a difference here. So that's one thing. We need tougher laws to protect whistleblowers and to help journalists, because this is really the central point. Another thing is that this is an old story in many ways. I came across Mossack Fonseca in 1987 when I was investigating General Noriega's drug trafficking, and they were already in Panama for 10 years. They'd been dealing with a Swiss banker I knew that was working for UBS. They were just one of a number of firms there. Basically, what you have here is a kind of global network that is channeling business to this 42 million revenue per year law firm. So it's you know, not the case that they're operating in a vacuum. They're not independent. They're not calling on Putin directly. They're getting all their business from more than 500 banks and law firms and accounting firms around the planet. So I think this revelation really highlights the sort of fact, you know, we have more than 200 countries that have turned up in this database. And this is a global network, and it's a global problem.
Mm-hmm. James, you use the word whistleblower. Does that mean you think it's an inside job?
I have no idea where it came from. I mean, whoever released it is obviously taking risks. And, you know, Mossack is saying it's a hacker. You know, that's to be determined. The big picture is that we validated the documents. The documents are real. And, you know, whistleblowers, in my experience, come forward for all kinds of reasons. You know, some of them are revenge motivated. Some of them are, you know, just doing it for public duty. In a sense, a journalist's job is not to sort of second guess the motives, but to see if the information is real and useful. And I think that stands up here.
Gerard, let me go back to you. We've seen in the last week the resignation of Iceland's prime minister, David Cameron. The British prime minister, you know, had to admit that his family had some involvement. We've got Vladimir Putin's cellist involved in some of these transactions. Just how global do you think these reverberations will be?
Well, an important point here is that even though Mossack Fonseca are based in Panama, they have offices all over the world, including here in the United States. So they've been operating globally, and their clients are global, as James pointed out. We're talking about major banks and financial institutions that were the actual clients. I mean, one of the first things that Mossack Fonseca said to us was that they actually denied that the people that we were naming were their clients. And it was a kind of what they were trying to say is that our clients are the banks, and we don't know who the end client is or who the actual human being is, which is pretty stunning to think that a system can work that way where they don't even know who's using the offshore companies, the secret offshore companies that they're setting up.
But is that kind of a wink, wink, what we don't know because we don't want to know?
Well, the evidence was there. I mean, for the journalists looking at this, it was very obvious. I mean, I recall one day typing in the word Pyongyang into the search engine we had built and found a company that had all the – its address was in North Korea. And then by cross-referencing that with the sanctions list, I found that, in fact, it had been sanctioned by the U.S. for being a front for the North Korean government. How Mossack Fonseca could not have known that and how they couldn't have done that basic due diligence is beyond belief. And it wasn't just a one-off example. It was example after example. There were 33 individuals or companies that had been sanctioned. And in some cases, Mossack Fonseca did not find out until they appeared on the sanctions list, and sometimes years later. And in fact, in one case, I recall, it was because the Mossack Fonseca address appeared in the sanctions list that alerted them.
Well, and Mossack Fonseca has said, we did nothing wrong. We were just essentially filing paperwork. We didn't know what this, you know, what these companies were involved in. Does that hold up, Gerard?
No. The documents, it's very clear in the documents that they knew that wrongdoing was taking place. And in fact, one of their senior people was saying that 95% of their business is about avoiding taxes and set up vehicles for avoiding taxes. And I think we're seeing that now in the reaction. At least two of their offices have been raided. And I hear this morning that their main office in Panama has been raided as we speak.
Let me go back to you, James Henry. You had a piece in Foreign Policy where basically you say, you know, Panama is just, you know, one law firm in one country. Help us understand, I guess, just sort of how large this network is that we're dealing with.
Yeah, foreign affairs. The network, our best estimate says of 2010 that there was about 21 to 32 trillion offshore of financial wealth invested through havens. About a third of that comes from developing countries. It has exploded since then with, you know, more than 1.3 trillion offshore flight wealth from Russia and more than a trillion that's left China in the last year alone. So, you know, what we're seeing here is really a whole network of entities that are, you know, sort of engaged in this. I mean, Mossack is probably correct that a lot of this behavior is technically legal, but that's actually the problem. Much of it is not, as Gerald said, but the sheer size of this underscores the fact that what we really need, I think, is an international commission on the whole industry, because you know, Credit Suisse, for example, has a law firm called Lentz and Sahelin that it uses in Geneva for much of its business, and they will be the ones who are contacting Mossack. But Credit Suisse has, you know, 2 million clients in 41 countries and $1 trillion of assets under management. And so if we had a whistle leak from them, you know, that would be I mean, we're talking about an industry that has the largest banks in the world. But some of the biggest ones involved in this scandal channeling business to Mossack were HSBC, which has at least 2,600 companies directly ordered from Mossack, and UBS and Credit Suisse, you know, some of the biggest European banks. You know, so there's really this extraordinary network. And I think what the opportunity exists is to actually have, for the first time, a detailed kind of roadmap and the kind of network map for all these connections.
Gerard, let me go back to you. In fact, you were last on the show talking about an investigation into HSBC and money laundering. And this is such a big story. And I wonder where the public outrage is. And maybe people are just fuming in their kitchens. But are you surprised that there hasn't been more public outrage? Or perhaps people are just used to hearing stories like this, and it tells them something that they sort of believe in their bones is true.
Well, I think it depends on which country we're talking about. We saw in Iceland that the biggest ever public protest in Icelandic history, 22,000 people surrounded Parliament, threw yogurt and fruit at the Parliament House until the Prime Minister resigned. You saw the same in Malta this week. And also we saw a lot of protests in London, where the Prime Minister of there, his home was surrounded by protesters. But I think most people, what we were doing here is confirming what I think most people know in their hearts. They know that there's one rule for certain people in the know, and there's one rule for the average person. And I think that's really why people should care about this, because they're the ones that are being affected by it. And it's very real. If people aren't paying taxes, then you're not going to have schools and roads and other public infrastructure.
And we're almost having a break here. Gerard, do we know how much tax is not being paid because of these tax havens?
If you're wealthy and you want to avoid tax, then you're going to go offshore. I don't see any real reason for their use at all, except for that, for either for criminals who want to hide or for people who want to avoid taxes. I mean, you will have arguments saying that this is all important to international business. But right beside that legitimate business is a lot of illegality, and we're seeing that in stark detail.
That is Gerard Ryle. And joining us along with James Henry, we are talking about what is now called the Panama Papers, and again, the largest whistleblower leak in history. I'm sure you read about it. We're going to take a very short break and talk more with our guests. And you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break, and we'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, talking with Gerard Ryle, investigative journalist, director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C., joining us from the studios of the Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C., and just last week released the Panama Papers. Also with us, James Henry. He's an investigative economist and lawyer. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and again, talking about the Panama Papers. 1-888-477-9499. James Henry, I do want to go back to you, and I'm actually looking at something that you had in Foreign Affairs, talking about these treasure islands, the Bahamas, Anguilla, Aruba, Barbados. You also include Cyprus, Gibraltar, the Isle of Man, Jersey, Guernsey, Malta, Monaco. And then the onshore secrecy jurisdictions, the City of London, Switzerland, Delaware, Nevada, Luxembourg, Dubai, Singapore, Malaysia, and Hong Kong. Talk to us a bit about Delaware, the role that Delaware and Nevada play when it comes to what, onshore secrecy?
Well, what's really here at stake here is not low tax rates necessarily. You know, if you imagine the Star Wars bar scene, you have kleptocrats and tax dodgers and drug dealers and money launderers of all denominations, who are basically using the same facility, which is financial secrecy. So what Delaware has, as well as Panama, in common with Panama, is the fact that there's no beneficial ownership registration, so we don't really know who owns companies and trusts there. And, in the last 2 decades, this kind of onshore industry has grown up in the U.S., so there's 49 states that offer LLCs and no beneficial ownership registration. You have Nevada and Alaska and 11 other states offering asset protection trusts that are just as good as the Cook Islands. But, kleptocrats are not bringing their money to Delaware. I mean, in Switzerland, you could walk into a bank with 500,000 euros in a suitcase and still deposit it with no trace. We have laws against bribery. And so Putin's not putting his money, in Delaware. So I think the we can exaggerate the degree to which this is identical to what Panama is engaged in. The U.S. is a tax haven. I mean, I think the first article I wrote about that was in the Washington Post in 1989. Mm. But it's mostly because our tax laws have been designed so that if you are a wealthy Mexican, a non-resident alien, we call it, you can live in the United States tax-free on your capital income, interest and dividends and stocks, basically live here 183 days a year tax-free and then move on to your London apartment or your Cap-d'Antibes house and live virtually tax-free, a citizen of nowhere, for tax purposes. And so that's one aspect of this that's very disturbing. The U.S. loses about $100 billion a year of tax revenue to this offshore industry, and Europe is probably at least as large. And the developing world, the issue is more kleptocracy than tax, but they're also losing out as well.
Gerard, let me go back to you, because one of the questions that's been raised, and I think James Henry just explained it, was the dearth of American names. Now, some names in the Panama Papers, but not perhaps on the level that we have seen or are seeing in other countries. Does what James Henry just said, does that explain what you found in the Panama Papers?
Look, it might partly explain it. It should be pointed out that the Panamanian laws that allowed this to happen are actually based on the original laws in Delaware. I would argue that America is actually becoming the biggest tax haven in the world. And it's not for Americans. It's for foreigners that are using American companies. This was the first time, this story was the first time that we ever saw behind the veil of secrecy mm-hmm. in Nevada and Wyoming. The one thing I should point out here is that almost every scandal has happened. I'm not talking about tax haven scandals, but every actual bribery scandal or scandals linked to kleptocrats, or they've all used tax havens, and a lot of them actually end up using American companies mm-hmm. because if you're using an American company, then there's a veil of sort of almost like legitimacy about it. It's the same reason why they go to New Zealand. People wouldn't think anything bad would happen out of New Zealand, but in fact, a lot of trusts and other things are set up in New Zealand simply to hide the assets and the wrongdoing of others around the world.
Well, let me quote the president of Panama in a piece in the New York Times. He says the association of Panama with offshore activities comes from the fact that we tax only income derived from within Panama, not from without, which remains taxable pursuant to the laws of relevant jurisdictions. He goes on to say these rules based on laws in New York and Delaware originated in 1927 and are common today. So, Gerard, the president of Panama, is correct?
Yes, I mean, he's defending himself by saying we're only doing what everyone else is doing. And I think that's the main problem here. Everyone's allowing this to happen. If the powers that be really wanted to stop it, they could do so tomorrow. But there's just too much money tied up in this world. I mean, I have read in the past that about a third of all world wealth is going through offshore tax havens. And when you have that amount of money going through, then you've got a lot of financial institutions and other big companies benefiting from it. And the other point that should be made clear here is that the money is not, stashed away in some Caribbean island or in Panama. It's actually staying in the big banks. They're the ones that are keeping the money. It's just that the offshore companies have been set up in secrecy jurisdictions, and then those offshore companies are linked to bank accounts in the mainstream banks.
James Henry, are we just talking money here? Or are we talking other things as well?
Well, as I said, there's a lot of misbehavior that's facilitated by these havens. I was just in South Africa investigating a major investment bank that was helping wealthy South Africans generate phony tax credits and, through what I would call fraudulent finance. So that's another whole theme of haven misbehavior. But I just want to go back to something that Gerald suggested. You know, half of Mossack Fonseca's companies here were from the BVI. About 100,000 companies.
British Virgin Islands, yeah.
That's an overseas territory. It's under the jurisdiction of Britain. One of the scandals here is that David Cameron has made promises like 3 years ago to clean up his own backyard. And, there's a whole spider web of UK entities around the planet, as well as the U.S. states and, the Swiss haven. So we really have, I would say, a multipolar haven industry, with the U.S. playing an increasing role because of the strength of the dollar, because of what's happening in China specifically. But again, the kleptocrats are not coming to Delaware. They're coming, from they tend to be going to the BVI.
BVI, British Virgin Islands. Gerard, though, do you think there are legitimate and legal reasons for secrecy for some kinds of banking or financial transactions?
I think there is some legitimacy in there. I mean, the argument will be that if you're a British company and you want to do business with a Chinese company, then you would rather have some sort of neutral territory where you can, British law, which is why a lot of people go to the British Virgin Islands and also Cayman Islands and other places. So, I mean, the argument is that you need a sort of a no man's land out there. But you can still have that without having the secrecy, and you can also have that without allowing the bad actors in there to basically play alongside what would be the legitimate part of this business.
And that's Gerard Ryle, investigative journalist, director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. That's at the Center for Public Integrity. Last week released the Panama Papers. Also with us, James Henry. He's an investigative economist and lawyer. He's also senior advisor in the Tax Justice Network. He does a lot of things, author of a number of books, including the forthcoming Pirate Bankers, 1-888-477-9499. We've got some comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to read some of these comments, but to you, James, do you think now that these wealthy people are on notice? I mean, we've got WikiLeaks, we've got James, we've got Snowden, and now we've got the Panama Papers revealing the private world of powerful people.
I don't think there's any evidence that they've necessarily changed their behavior. I mean, when I started investigating this, Panama was like one of 10 havens in the world that was of any substantial significance. Now there's more than 90, as I said. So there's a lot of places to go and a great deal of work to do before we can count on this. Again, this is a huge, very lucrative global industry of enablers. And I think if we want to tackle the problem, we have to take the profit out of the business of basically hiding money onshore or offshore, and to have tougher laws for professionals or for banks that actually put people in jail for facilitating this.
How do you do that, though, especially on a global scale?
Well, the OECD and the G20 have talked about and are in the process of implementing new disclosure rules on beneficial ownership and, information in exchange. And that's one approach, is to penalize institutions that don't reveal that institution, that information. Panama has not signed up to the OECD standards, and yet they got to do a trade treaty with us in 2011. So, first of all, we have to stop rewarding bad behavior and financial secrecy. I think the U.S. has some work to do, as Gerald indicated, to clean up our own secrecy jurisdictions, and we should have beneficial ownership registration for Delaware and the other states that are involved in these secret conduit entities. Delaware gets about 25% of its state revenue every year from these corporations. So there's a powerful lobby in Washington to overcome here before we get that done. But you know, having public officials have to declare their wealth, you know, and their tax returns, I think that's a basic requirement. We're going to need better laws for whistleblowers. We need, you know, to have international cooperation among these jurisdictions. There's been something called tax competition, kind of a race to the bottom since the 1980s. We've had taxes on corporations and individuals being cut, even as this haven industry was growing. So, the United States would cut taxes, and then Canada would cut taxes. And so we've had this very bad thing of race to the bottom. And that's another thing that we need to get out of so that we have tougher cooperation across borders.
Well, and Gerard, not to be overly cynical here, but if we're talking about powerful politicians, powerful business leaders, celebrities, wealthy people, well-connected people who are taking advantage of these tax havens, what is the kind of pressure that would get them to change their ways or perhaps even change the laws? And is it sort of naming and shaming? Is that an effective tool?
Yes, I think so. I think the only way you've got to, it's very simple. I see it very simply in a way. It's all about secrecy. If you can eliminate the secrecy, then you can eliminate the wrongdoing. And what we saw in the Panama Papers is that every time major governments like OECD, government bodies like that, or the European Union tried to crack down on bad behavior, all this industry did was find new and clever ways of doing the same thing. And we saw example after example there. I think the only way this is ever going to happen is either if there is a global effort to end it, and I think that would be relatively simple, or we just keep embarrassing people until the point where they know that eventually they're going to get caught, and politicians such as the ones that had, you know, have to, and bankers and other people that had to resign this week, and there's been several resignations, until you put that kind of pressure on them, then this is going to continue.
Gerard, let me read a comment or question actually from P, who says, will you discuss the appearance of John and Anthony Podesta and Sidney Blumenthal in the expose, especially since John Podesta is Hillary Clinton's campaign manager? Can you add to that?
I can't. That was, I think, reporting done by our partners here in McClatchy Group, if I'm correct. What we do when we build these coalitions or these collaborations is that we have media organizations in each country, and we don't tell them what to do. They basically decide themselves. I think we're going to find more revelations in the US because we've basically got a lot of people now looking at the documents here because they're finding that with the question is, why aren't there more American names? Well, the reason is because we haven't looked hard enough yet, and we're looking harder now.
James Henry, a question from Chris says, isn't this setup being revealed as a means for governments to access funding to perform potentially illicit activities such as black ops? Is it?
No, I don't think it's being revealed for that purpose. I mean, we've, you know, the idea that it's a U.S. government plot, I think, is ridiculous here. We have lots of allies of the U.S. that have been exposed, former President Mubarak in Egypt, Poroshenko, who's president of the Ukraine, David Cameron, the prime minister of Iceland. These are you know, not on the enemies list of the United States. No, I think at best you could say that this may have been a leak that got out of control. But, I mean, it's already having a salutary, you know, effect on the whole world system. The point is that We really don't want to have revelation fatigue here. We want to, I think, begin to do something about the problem that will, you know, raise the penalties for the facilitators, the enablers all over the planet.
Gerard, we have an email from Beverly. She says, I may not be in my kitchen, but I'm fuming about what the Panama Papers represents, just as I'm fuming at what Jane Mayer's Dark Money represents. It's the author of a book called Dark Money. The wealthy feel privileged and have different standards than anyone else because of their wealth. The whole process is corrupt. Gerard?
Well, I think you do have problems. If you have a lot of money, then the issue is you're trying to keep that money. And I think this is the way some people are. What I remember from looking at the Panama Papers was some bizarre things that were going on. The offers that Mossack Fonseca were making to U.S. citizens. I recall one in particular, a very wealthy woman from Florida who was being offered fake invoices from a real UK company to avoid paying taxes here. They even offered to set up a fake charity for her in Panama where she could put her money in. And in the end, I think the money did go overseas and it was turned into gold bullion. And again, it was hidden behind an offshore company.
James Henry, one of the things that I've been reading is that when you look at the real estate prices in places like New York and perhaps London, some other big cities around the globe, that in part is because you've got wealthy people with a lot of money in these tax havens, and they are inflating the prices of real estate. True, not true?
Oh, it's true. I mean, you don't have to go there. Just look at Vancouver. China is pouring money into the Canadian market to the point where it's virtually unaffordable to live in Vancouver these days. No, I think real estate and other non-financial assets like, paintings. We've seen the role of Panama Papers and a very interesting story about all these Picassos that have been accumulated in Freeport in Switzerland. You know, they're basically using paintings for a kind of money laundering. So if you have $50 million to launder, you buy a Picasso or sell it, and, what's that worth? There's a lot of, sort of almost endless chicanery here and involving so many different institutions. I think what we really need at the end of the day is an independent sort of international commission on this with subpoena power to really investigate this industry. We've had this example in Guatemala over the last year. The UN had an outsider come in and investigate, and they basically got rid of the corrupt president there just in the last year. So that's the kind of one possible step forward here. But I think Gerald is right. We're going to have to continue to rely on journalists and whistleblowers for the bulk of this, because governments have a history of not really acting.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the Panama Papers in this hour of Radio Times with James Henry and Gerard Ryle. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and by now you have heard of the Panama Papers. This is a trove of something like 11.5 million documents leaked from a Panamanian law firm, revealing names of the rich and powerful across the globe who have used offshore bank accounts to hide their wealth and to not pay taxes. The papers were released last week. Every day there's new information and new developments. And again, joining us is Gerard Ryle, head of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that organized a team of reporters to comb through all this data. And also with us is James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer. He's written a number of books about tax havens and some of these shell companies. And he's also a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. James Henry, let me go back to you. And I'm looking at something that Carl Levin wrote actually in The Guardian, basically saying it's easier to get a library card in the United States than to form a U.S. corporation. Now, he's been a member of Congress for some time now, but is he onto something here?
I think he meant it's harder to get a library card.
I'm sorry. Exactly the opposite. It is harder to get a library card. Yes, you're absolutely right.
We miss Senator Levin. He was one of the big people who was fighting for transparency, and he did investigations of many institutions like Citibank and Credit Suisse and Goldman Sachs that were engaged in the chicanery. Gerard's basic point, I think, about the United States is sort of deeply embarrassing to those of us who care about this. We have prosecuted Swiss banks like Credit Suisse and UBS for helping wealthy Americans take money out. But the fact is that it is far too easy to have sort of secret companies in the U.S. And the head of Mossack was asked about where he kept his money some time ago. And he said, well, I keep it in Delaware. They'll never find it. There's a million companies in Delaware, sort of on a BVI scale. And it's there's a one big service company in Delaware that has a third of the business there, much bigger than Mossack. So, this is unfortunately an area for the U.S. to clean up its act and not being hypocritical.
Gerard, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I think it's significant that people, even like President Obama, before he became president, was very critical of how easy it was to set up companies in jurisdictions. But of course, when he came into power, nothing happened. And if anything, I think it's grown over the last few years. So as James pointed out earlier, there's a lot of money involved, a lot of money involved in actually setting up these companies. I mean, it's they take fees for doing it. And it's becoming now part of state revenue. I mean, these Caribbean islands we're talking about, right, they rely almost entirely on the offshore industry. And it's becoming more so here in the United States. And when you have money, of course, you have lobbying and you have interest and you have people who don't want it to end.
Does it explain, Gerard, the growing disparity between rich and poor, maybe even rich and the not so rich or the middle class, not just in the United States, but around the world?
Yeah, I think we're seeing the super wealthy here. People, when we talk about real estate, there's actually a bus tour now in London where you can get on a bus and go around and see all of the houses, very wealthy houses there that are owned by offshore companies, some of whom, of course, have been revealed in the Panama Papers. Until now, we didn't know who the real owners were. Mm. They're mostly Russian, Chinese and other people coming from overseas. But James mentioned earlier the Picassos and the Van Goghs that are now being used. I mean, what's happening there is that these paintings are actually being owned by offshore companies. And again, it's all about secrecy so that no one really knows who the real owner is. And they never get, they never get shown at museums anymore. They're just stuck in a free port in Switzerland. And in fact, we had a raid as a result of the Panama Papers. This was place raided and seized one of these paintings, one of the paintings that we talked about.
Well, and it maybe explains why, not that Picassos aren't worth millions of dollars, but just the unbelievable prices some of this artwork Gerard is getting.
Well, it's because the super wealthy don't know where else to put their money. And what's happening now is that these, things like high-end art are actually being used to store and to hide wealth. Also, you see a lot of money going into gold bullion, which is also being stored in the free ports in Switzerland.
In fact, James, I'm looking at your foreign affairs report. Real estate, gold and other precious metals, precious gems, art, rare books, cars, religious icons, photos, other collectibles, yachts, ships, submarines, private jets, real estate farms, mines, forests and oil fields, all owned through anonymous haven companies, trust foundations and private vaults, now worth at least another $5 to $10 trillion.
Yeah, I think the point about inequality is important because, the Piketty stuff in 2013 basically relied on some methods to really underestimate, I think, the scale of this offshore industry. We're talking about wealth that's owned by at most 10 million people on the planet, about the top 0.1%. Mm-hmm. And, there's at least 20 to 30 trillion of that. So it's highly concentrated. It really does exaggerate we already knew that inequality was growing, but because of this industry, it's grown even more. And I think all of the wealth you're referring to in these free ports, well, there are free ports in Luxembourg. There's one in Singapore. There's another one in Miami. So, choose your poison. We have no information about who owns what in those free ports. They're totally left out of U.S. Tax treaties and the FATCA rules, they're just a black hole. But that's another problem for us to work on.
The idea that the anonymity, which is people don't know the names of the people involved or these alleged companies, James?
Well, we found when I investigated the Marcos regime back in the Philippines, so they had basically used the Philippine Central Bank as a piggyback bank to channel $7 billion offshore that they'd borrowed from New York banks, and they sent it right to Switzerland, and they ended up with about several billion dollars of gold sitting in Swiss free ports. This is just one example of many, but the free ports are a real glaring loophole.
Let me get Anne from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
This is about the justifications for secrecy that economists keep trying to foist on us. I used to invest in bears bonds, and I'm not allowed to do that anymore. Presumably, secrecy isn't a good thing.
Hmm.
that loophole was closed, but I'm just an ordinary person, a small investor, not a billionaire or a millionaire or a corporation.
What I hear you saying is that there are rules for people like you, and then it looks like there are rules for the wealthy and well-connected. Gerard, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, well, I think we're talking also about bearer shares. And this is what got the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, in trouble, because his father actually was making his money out of bearer shares. And basically, this was bearer shares are essentially certificates that if you physically hold them, then you're the owner of the company. The reason why they've become outlawed in most countries now is that it was a very easy way for people to money launder. Again, embarrassment is now beginning to clean them up. And there are a few places still. And we saw in the Mossack Fonseca files that as one jurisdiction would stop you using it, they would simply move to another jurisdiction. And they just kept hopscotching around the world and kept offering that as one of the services for the big banks. And remember, it was the clients of the big banks that they were servicing. Mossack Fonseca.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. James, a tweet from Lojo says, he says, did the law Obama passed in 2010, help to limit the number of U.S. people implicated? There was a 2010 law, I believe, that was passed to address some of what we've been talking about. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. That's called the FATCA rule, F-A-T-C-A. You can Google it. I can't keep track of all the underlying acronym meanings, but basically it required foreign banks that wanted to operate in the United States either to be subject to withholding tax or to have to give up information about the interest being earned on and income being earned on so-called offshore accounts that might be held by Americans. You know, that was a step forward, but I don't think anyone believes that it's, I mean, there's no single bullet solution to this thing. Mm. And there's a lot of loopholes. You mentioned bearer shares. Switzerland still has bearer bonds and bearer shares that are legal. In fact, Credit Suisse, if you take a look at their stock ownership, a third of Credit Suisse is owned by, we don't know who owns them, the bearer shares. So, you know, that's one of the, that's like the second largest Swiss bank. You know, there's a lot of these technical loopholes to be fixed. The point is to I think the problem, and Gerard has underlined this, this is a political problem that we're facing. It's not a technical problem. There's tons of reforms that we could imagine. But, you know, the Obama administration, the current head of the IRS, chief legal counsel of the late IRS, is a former registered representative for the Swiss Bankers Association. I mean, the Obama track record on prosecuting and putting bankers in jail has been, you know, very disappointing to us who were expecting him to do more. So, yes, we got FATCA, thanks to Senator Levin, but
we need more.
You know, this is an ongoing problem.
Let me get Mary from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a lawyer and a journalist, and I've worked in a lot of the countries that have been coming up in the Panama Papers. And one thing I'm very curious about in terms of all the talk about secrecy and anonymity is the nature of the source. I've seen very, very little examination of who this person was, what their motivations are, and how that affects the reliability of all the documents.
Well, Mary,
so I'd like to hear some discussion about that.
You called the right place because I'm going to give that to Gerard Ryle. Gerard, go ahead.
Sure. We don't know who the source is.
Yeah, you can. But thanks, Mary, for the call.
Okay. I mean, the source is a source belonging to a journalist in Germany called Bastian Obermeier. I don't believe he knows who the source is. There was a huge burden on us at the beginning of this to go outside the documents to verify that this was real. The documents have proved, I mean, by having 370 journalists from more than 70 countries looking at it and opening it up for more than a year to all the journalists, to me, that justifies what has come out justifies what happened. And I do believe that the motivations of the source, even though I don't know who the source is, are genuine. They said that they were witnessing in the documents that they were seeing crimes, and therefore they wanted it to come out publicly. And that was the only motivation that they gave for doing this.
This is something that James Henry was saying earlier, but Gerard, do you see then journalists and investigative journalists playing an important role because for whatever reason, governments or institutions or government departments or individuals either aren't or won't address or take a look at this world of shadow banking.
Yes, I think if the governments had gone ahead and done what they should have done years ago, then we wouldn't be in the situation. If people weren't embarrassed by this, then we wouldn't basically be in this situation. So I do think, though, that this is a fundamental shift in society that's going on at the moment. We're in the era of these big leaks. People are able to get documents on a scale never thought possible before. And I think that we're at the beginning of this process. Yeah. We're going to see more and more. And of course, as journalists, I mean, I was heartened to hear Bob Woodward, the very famous Watergate journalist, saying a few days ago that journalists should not turn down information. But of course, we do have an obligation then to make sure that what we're doing is in the public interest. And, we found more than 140 politicians from around the world in these documents. And I think that, to me, is of public interest.
Absolutely. Let me read a couple comments here. A question from Kathy. How do people find out about these shell companies and offshore accounts to store their money in? And I guess they can go to your organization, Gerard.
Well, we're going to, as I say, release a limited amount of information. But, I mean, it's the kind of information that people like David Cameron, the reason why he was so embarrassed by this is that he has actually been campaigning for a number of years, saying that the basic information, who is the beneficial owner of a company, no matter where they are, should be made public. And I think this is why he's now basically so embarrassed by what's come up, because in fact it turned out that he himself benefited personally from the activities of his father, of his late father.
James Henry, we have a caller here. We don't have time to take her call, but Linda wants to know from Phoenixville, where does all the money go for all the people who got caught? An interesting question. What do you think?
Well, I'd love to know how much money is actually, as I understand it, there's no actual asset data in this account, in this revelation. So Gerard could enlighten us as to that. But, in theory, a lot of these players have closed some of these companies, and, many of them have redomiciliation provisions so that they can jump to another haven if something like this happens. So I'm sure there's a lot of activity in Panama. We came across there was one person on the law firm staff in Panama who was listed as a director on 24,000 of these companies. So. They're probably burning the midnight oil trying to figure out what to do. But we don't know. Gerard?
Quickly, Gerard. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I would say that, we publish on Sunday night, U.S. time. I'd say by Monday morning you would have had a flood of people going to the IRS and volunteering that they may have had some dealings with Mossack Fonseca. That's what we've seen in the past. Mm. We're going to see a flood of money to the U.S. Treasury and to other treasuries around the world as a result of this.
Let me just read an email from Beth. It's a long email here. She says, it's too broad of a brushstroke to say that if you are wealthy and have trust in Delaware, that you're not paying your fair share. We could go on. We do have to end on that note. Gerard Ryle, thank you so much for joining us today once again on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C., joining us from the Monitor Studios in D.C. And again, he has been organizing the release of the Panama Papers. James Henry, thank you very much as well.
You're quite well.
And he's an investigative economist, a lawyer, also a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. He's written a number of books. He's got a forthcoming one called Pirate Bankers. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.